much. So I just have some comments on the three papers. I'm going to do something crazy. I'm going to change the order in which I talk about them, and you have a list. Actually, it won't be that crazy. I have a reason for it. So I'm going to start with Christine's, and then Stephen's, and then move to Andrew's. So Christine, the paper, I think there's a motivation behind the paper that doesn't actually emerge until later in the paper, and I just wanted to draw that out right at the beginning. And at least what I see as what motivates much of the paper, and that's that it's something like, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the view that a society, and indeed the market, so both the society and the market more particularly, is not just a set of individuals who make free choices, but also that they have structural features that impact what options and goods are available in a systematic way for individuals. So that's to say, it's a kind of challenge to straight neutrality, because the doctrine of state neutrality, because the thought here might be something like that neutrality doesn't leave it up to individuals to decide, but rather leaves it up to other structural features of the society or the market. So that, for example, market actors. So that at least with politics, individuals are supposed to have some say over the shaping of the value landscape, if you like. So rather than having a contrast between conscious collective control versus individual control, it's rather a contrast between conscious collective control versus unaccountable market actors and indeed market failures. I think that, as I understand, much of the motivation behind the paper really that. So if you like to have a sort of metaphor for it, if you've been to Houston, right, it's the nightmare of Houston. It looked like hell on earth to me. As opposed to a city that has zoning laws and cares about the aesthetic or whatever, the quality of life. And that it's collectively controlled rather than left to market failure. Okay, so getting more specifically into the account, I have a few questions that I just wanted to pose for you. You identify three constituents to the life well lived. First of all, autonomy, which I think roughly you flesh out as an ability to set and pursue projects in some way. Second, the idea that some pursuits are objectively worthwhile, and then a subjective component, which you call contentment. I suspect that has something to do with subjectively actually endorsing the kind of pursuits that you're living, at least in part, that should be a component. So the question that I want to ask is what kind of policies you might be willing to adopt more specifically, just if you could flesh this out, in order to address that subjective component. So yes, there are structural features that may impact the contentment that people might feel with their lives, but obviously there are also psychological features, and I'm wondering what kinds of actions you think that the state should engage in, providing for, say, psychological counseling. But then once we kind of move in that route, I wonder if there's another kind of dystopia, not Houston, but the one of social engineering, and you can see where that's going. Then there's also an argument that you make against Sen and Nussbaum, where you prefer functioning rather than capabilities, emphasizing this as the object for equality. And the one reason why you give for this is because well-being requires success. That's part of the justification that you give for this favoring of functioning rather than capability. So here's the question. Doesn't well-being also require the possibility of failure, and indeed, doesn't it require failure? And in particular, if you think that autonomy is a constituent of well-being, doesn't the exercise of autonomy precisely, in part at least, consist in the risk of failure? So there is this kind of a mood in the paper that strikes me as one that is attempting to immunize against the possibility of risk. The strong challenge might be that actually the possibility of risk and the failures that come with risk may also be part of an autonomous life and hence part of the life well lived. The second kind of argument that you give for this is about the content of functionings rather than the point that well-being requires success. So when you flesh this out, and here I have another question about this, you give examples of, say, participation and fellowship with other peoples, but again, right, this is going to this drives you right into the kinds of intuitions that drive anti-perfectionists. So what about the hermit and the recluse, those people who chafe at the burden of social relationships. What would you have to say about those individuals and the impact that that should have on the kinds of policies that the state should adopt? Which obviously then raises the issue of which particular conceptions of the good, right, are informing state policy. And then final question for you is about holding people responsible for work and their choices, and part of the reason why you think that this should be done is that holding people responsible for their choices is actually good for them. So again, a question about the subjective component. What if it turns out that I hate the activity of production, right? So don't hold me responsible in this way, because subjectively at least, even though the objective component might be a worthwhile pursuit, I nonetheless hate this. You presumably, I think, want to say that, well, the problem really is the circumstances, the structural circumstances that led to my lethargy or even anomie, because productivity is actually good for me, objectively speaking. Okay, but my question would be, well, what should be done in the meantime? Is the upshot of your view that I'm actually lacking in some way because I don't have the right kind of view about what kinds of pursuits are worthwhile, objectively speaking? Should I be compensated in the meantime until the state manages to convince me that I should not be a surfer or whatever it is? Okay, so moving on to Stephen Wall. If I could just sort of rehearse part of the argument here, is imagine that there are three ideals, A, B, and C, that are all possible, what Stephen calls eligible in the particular society, and they are worthy ideals. But that reason does not dictate which one to pursue, either because, for example, they are of equal value, or because it's just simply incommensurable, we can't decide. We can't rationally rank them for either of those reasons, and also assume that each of these ideals has adherence in society. The restricted neutrality principle suggests that in aiming to promote the good, the state should not promote A, B, or C over each other, although it may promote them over other so-called ideals. So the thought here, I want to lay out in four steps. Okay, so first, is that we can't rationally rank these options between them, so there's no reason to favor one over the other, and so it is arbitrary to pick one or the other. That's the first point. The second point is that, therefore, it's illegitimate for the state to arbitrarily favor some ideal over the other amongst these three. And the third point, which I think you take to be similar or implied in some way because of the relationship, say, between legitimacy and justice, that arbitrary discrimination like this would be unjust. And the fourth point is, from this, then you derive the restricted neutrality principle. Now, Stephen, I think, wants to challenge the derivation of the fourth, the restricted neutrality principle, from the third, which is to say that arbitrary discrimination would be unjust. In other words, is there some way other than the restricted neutrality principle to avoid arbitrary discrimination? That's part of the way that I understand the paper. But what I'd like to do is I'd actually like to start by first challenging the derivation of the second point, which is that it's illegitimate for the state to arbitrarily favor some ideal over another. This, it seems to me, turns on an equivocation in the formulation of the first premise, which is that which is to say when one says that a choice is arbitrary. One may have no reason to favor A, B, or C in particular, so that the particular choice is arbitrary in that sense, but one may have reason to pick one ideal arbitrarily, so that while the content of the choice is arbitrary, that one chooses is not. So here, think of an analogy about which side of the road the state should require you to drive on. It's arbitrary, but nonetheless, it's not arbitrary that the state chooses one side rather than another. There's a reason for it. Similarly, if the pursuit of A, B, and C together are incompatible, but one has reason to choose at least one of them, is it really true that it's illegitimate for the state to arbitrarily favor some ideal over another if the state has some compelling reason to arbitrarily choose one such ideal? So think here of Hobbes and his views about theology and value beyond the laws of nature and the value of self-preservation. This is, I think, what we might call his "will everybody just chill out" strategy. So there's no reason that's available for choosing one particular, say, religious or evaluative ideal over another, but the state has a compelling reason to choose one arbitrarily and impose it, namely a civil religion, for example. Furthermore, it does so legitimately, on this account, because doing so serves an urgent interest shared by all, whatever conception of good that they have, namely the interest in security that's necessary for their self-preservation. So that no one, on this view, has a legitimate ground for complaint if the state chooses a religious ideal A because it's, after all, arbitrary which ideal one lives. And it's arbitrary in the sense that reason can't settle the matter for us. So it's a bit like the randomization strategy here, which you criticize. And what you say is that it fails to treat the matter seriously enough. But I think the Hobbesian point here would be is that it's actually not serious at all. There's nothing serious at stake, because we can't rationally decide between these. It's arbitrary, and so it's not serious whether we choose A or B. But if we have reason to choose one over another, and if the state has reason to choose one over the other to promote, there's no problem. So that's the kind of challenge that I wanted to throw. But now, how could this reasoning be resisted? It seems to me that it could be resisted if the individual has reason for complaint, because we think that the satisfaction of individual preferences is of value. Or that the exercise of choice is valuable, or et cetera, et cetera. Some kind of response like that. So there appears to be a tacit premise in getting from stage one to stage two, either the intrinsic value of preference satisfaction, or the value of autonomy, or some response like that. In other words, value pluralism yields the restricted neutrality principle only if it's a restricted kind of value pluralism. A kind of secondary value pluralism that arises only once the value, let's say, of autonomy has been recognized, or something else, like welfareism. So I think that the weight of the paper is actually not in favor of welfareism, so autonomy, so that's what I'll focus on. So here's a question. Did you really accept value pluralism for the purposes of the paper, or did you begin with a kind of monism about the value of autonomy and then take on limited pluralism about particular ends, of equally valid or incommensurable ideals or goods that one might pursue against the background of autonomy? Now, moving to Stephen's own challenge, the derivation of the restricted neutrality principle. One challenge here that you propose is the is that we might be able to aggregate conflicting premises, conflicting preferences for those ideals A, B, or C. Through a fair decision procedure, so that this is a way to avoid arbitrary discrimination because one has reason to discriminate, namely the reason given by the fair procedure. So in the case of divisible goods, you say, well, why don't we can fairly divide the support that the state provides to these ideals according to numbers. Again, though, doesn't it seem as if the weight of numbers only counts if, for example, we presuppose the value of preference satisfaction? Isn't that a presupposition? In the case of indivisible goods, the suggestion here is that the fairness of the procedure may require accommodations for those who lose out. So I think that the tacit reliance on the primary value of autonomy, of course, comes out more clearly on what my printout was around page 13, where you make that distinction between state favoring a autonomy-supporting environment versus supporting alternative goods within that environment. Now, just to move to the end of my comments on this, the limit that Stephen considers on the fair aggregation strategy is to think about when a person's merited self-worth is at stake. So sometimes promoting A over B when I'm invested in B will be taken to express a negative judgment on B, and this may compromise the basis of my sense of self-worth. So the reason, and if we take it that the state has reason not to damage my sense of self-worth, if it's wrapped up with this valuable ideal, then one might have reason to respect the restricted neutrality principle when we experience these ideals in this way that impinges on our self-worth. So my question is, regarding the value of self-worth itself, especially the conditional value of self-worth that you posit. That's to say that self-worth is only valuable if it's wrapped up in a pursuit of a life that is in fact valuable. Isn't there a tension between this and the value of autonomy, which seems to be presupposed elsewhere in the paper? Again, it's the point about risk. The free exercise of autonomy always carries risks, and the particular ideals that I set and pursue may turn out to be mistaken ideals, but that's precisely what it is that I thought that the value of autonomy was at least in part supposed to constitutively permit, and including the kinds of ideals that I stake my self-worth on. So it might turn out, right, that for example, in fact, I'm only temporarily mistaken, in that the ideal that I'm pursuing is not eligible in the sense of not possible in the society that I live in the current social circumstances, but that I hope to make it possible. Think here of artists or marginals or whoever, what kinds of people there are that like to experiment with different kinds of lifestyle. So more generally, the point would be that the environment necessary for autonomy may require an environment where we can go wrong evaluatively in our life experiments. Right? This is something that we might associate with John Stuart Mill and his celebration of individuality. And then just final comment, doesn't the appeal to neutrality at the end of the paper just really become a rhetorical device of some kind? The real work is done by the ideal of self-worth and the reasons that we have not to damage it. I think there's a sense in which you acknowledge this, but I just wanted to see whether you'd be willing to acknowledge it in that stronger form, saying that, well, really, we could really dispense with this. You're just doing it for political purposes in the academy. Okay, so Andrew, the task here is to get a defense of marriage while being able to critique heterosexual only marriage. And the task is to get this result by appeal to public reason. Three strategies. The ideal independent benefits for third parties. That's the first one. So Andrew considers three, rejects the first two, and I want to mount a defense of the two, I think. The thought here is that there may be ordinary public benefits, for example, with a two-parent family. So public-spirited individuals necessary for liberal democracy, Galston, benefit not just for married people, even though it makes them happy, but benefits for others, such as less crime, care for children, etc., etc. So what are the objections? One is to deny the empirical claim. This is something that Andrew considers. The other is that, this is what Andrew, I think, is more interested in. If marriage produces no good benefits, then it looks like it's not justified. And you present this as a problem with this view. I'm not sure why it's a problem with the view. It seems actually to be an advantage of the view. If marriage doesn't provide good benefits, then why should we want to justify it at all? That seems like a strength. We shouldn't crucify ourselves to social institutions that don't produce anything good for us. The second problem that you raise with this, with the first strategy, is that marriage, it portrays marriage as a necessary evil in light of people's unjust partiality towards their own children. I'm not really sure I quite see this. It seems that to get this idea that it's treating it as a necessary evil is to treat the relationship that we have to children as a mere preference or desire or an expensive taste, and one that is unjust at that. I think that this ignores the non-instrumental value of relationships. This is something that Scheffler, for example, argues. I think that, in fact, I would argue that non-instrumentally valuable human relationships are a basic human good that ought to be recognized as such. I think this problem shows up in the treatment of the also instrumental value of the parental relationship for children, relation to children. It's not just a matter of the economic context. So although it's true that the children of divorced parents would be helped if they were not mired in poverty, so that's true, it would mitigate the negative impact. But it wouldn't fully mitigate the negative impact because of, for example, non-economic reasons for the psychological trauma. I think that the way that you respond is by appeal to the possibility of socialized childcare. But again, I think that that appeal ignores the basic human good that I mentioned, which is non-instrumentally valuable relationships, of which we might think that the parent-child one is a particularly important one. So it's not just an expensive taste, but perhaps a component to the good life. Okay, so then the second strategy is a perfectionist defense of marriage that's permitted because of the constraint of public reason being limited to some only certain policies, namely ones that are only paternalistic, that limit options, or that are only for the person's own good. And here you consider the argument, for example, inspired by Eras, that marriage actually does not limit, the institution of marriage doesn't limit options, but expands them. Why? Because it's dependent on social forms that provide valuable options, and the provision of valuable options is autonomy enhancing. And Raz's argument is that social recognition is a constitutive feature of this option of marriage. So, the objection, as I understand it, is that this seems to open the door to the possibility that one would recognize marriage, but still be able to deny gay marriage. I wasn't really sure why this would necessarily open the door that wide anyways, because it seems as if one is making an argument about a range of valuable options. It seems that this is an argument actually in favor of different legal arrangements that should be available to people from which they could choose, including not just marriage, as it's traditionally understood, but gay marriage, but also relationships that are not marriage. For example, a caregiver relationship between parent and child. So what's the justification here then for the denial of the options, for denial of some options, and in particular some options for some people? I think Stephen Wall's proposal to focus here on the issue of self-esteem and the kinds of or self-worth and the kinds of recognition that may be required for that is relevant here. Also, a question for the Razian account is, it's not clear to me why the recognition of the social form has to be political all the way down. That's to say that, yes, there is a political basis for this kind of social recognition, but it's not clear to me that it has to be a fully political recognition. Why not recognize various kinds of union and leave it up to actors in civil society to sacralize it as marriage themselves? So what the state would do is to recognize different kinds of unions, get out of the marriage business, and provide that legal framework, but that then the further recognition of those relationships as marriage or not could be carried out by other associations. Just a final point about the option that you do go for, which is that the option of restricting the range of reasons that are excluded as non-public by appeal to the inevitability of the controversy regarding these particular kinds of doctrines. Okay, so the standard account that you attribute to Rawls is that one limits the constraint of public reason to those things that are, as a matter of sociological fact, persistently controversial. But you say that this is too broad a definition of a non-public reason, because legislation that is based on non-public reason in this sense is no disrespect if, in fact, for example, the contested view, as a matter of sociological fact, it will be contested because we don't have enough time to talk about it, is nonetheless true. So even though you don't accept the true view, you could reasonably accept it, and that's the criterion that you appeal to. I think this actually depends on an ambiguity or an equivocation in not just the paper, but I think in general in discussions about this standard of reasonable acceptability. I want to distinguish between, first of all, and the equivocation is between the reasonable acceptability criteria and the can't reasonably reject criteria. These are not the same. So, for example, if I can't reasonably accept something, it follows that I can reasonably reject it. Also, if I can't reasonably reject something, it follows that I can reasonably accept it. But, this is a third option, it may be the case that I can both reasonably accept something and reasonably reject it. Think here, okay, if we're thinking metaphysically, think here of the options between A, B, and C in Stevens' construal, right? We can both reasonably reject it and reasonably accept it, it being, for example, ideal A. We have reason to accept it, it's worthwhile, but we can also have reason to reject it if we want to opt for B. There's reasons for opting for B after all. Okay, so where the reasons are equal, or where they're incommensurable between options, and we can't determine the issue, this is a possibility. And also, instead of a metaphysical issue, one might think, along with Rawls, that there are epistemological reasons for why this might also be true. If One can discern the reasons that favor one, but can't be reasonably expected that everyone will discern those reasons. So whether we construe it metaphysically or epistemologically, it seems to me that this option of the reasonable acceptability and reasonable rejectability of certain options, the same option, is available. So reasonable acceptability is too broad. In other words, it's too easy because you can now impose things on me that I can reasonably reject. And your worry was that this was too broad. So perhaps it's not so broad. And then just a final question about the inevitability of reasonable contestability. I'm not really sure what to think about this. The view, I think, here that you're advancing is that it's in principle. There are certain things that are in principle impossible, even in an ideal speech situation, to come to a consensus on. And my worry is whether it's really true that one could in this way distinguish theological questions from, say, empirical questions. But I guess it would take more articulated, and I should probably stop there. So perhaps we could just open it up in whichever order you want. Should I open it up to the speakers? Do you want to reply something, or do you want to open it up to...
That has been the
reply, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's up to you.
Sure.
Well, thank you. Can you... Is this working? No. Sorry. Can you hear me now? Is it okay now? Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, folks. Well, thank you very much indeed, Arash. Those are really helpful comments and questions, and very helpful. I'm glad you threw me a bone as I asked you to at the beginning. And yes, indeed, I do say exactly what you suggest I should say, that the contrast is best thought of not in terms of individuals choosing versus the state imposing, but state-directed environment versus unaccountable forces doing the choosing for us, like the market. So that was helpful. Maybe I should bring that up more. I realize that you asked a lot of questions, and I'll be here forever if I go through them all in detail, but I just want to hit on them a little bit. The second point you raised was the three constituents of human flourishing that I mentioned. The third one, the subjective reaction to the pursuits one engages in, which I call contentment or happiness, and you said could also be thought of as endorsing. I'm not sure whether endorsing is quite right, since that might feed back into the autonomy choosing part of the trilogy. But you did ask the question about what will we do to further that third aspect. Psychological counseling, you suggested darkly, as a kind of breaking world scenario, which obviously I don't want to go there. But I think we can say whether or not people are happy is something that there are environmental factors that we can affect. And it's been interesting, there's quite a range for sort of happiness studies that are pointing out fairly obvious things that make people happy or not happy. Spending a lot of time in your car apparently makes you less happy than not spending a lot of time in your car. So things like trying to have better cycle paths and pedestrian walkways and public transit systems would be a way of making people more happy, which avoids having a violent Orwellian psychiatrist couches to gee us up into appropriate levels of happiness. So I would stress that kind of direction. The third question you asked was about functioning versus capabilities. And I feel like deferring to Chris Lowry, one of my PhD students, who's a Sen expert, and who will tell you all about these issues tomorrow. But I'll struggle on feebly myself here for a moment. I think it gets very tricky thinking of my preferred functioning or flourishing, as I call it, over capabilities in terms of success, because you're quite right that the flourishing life involves attempts that don't work out, and we don't want to immunize people against risk. So I said success, I meant more doing and achieving rather than having the opportunity that you don't actually engage with. But perhaps success is a bad word to use because it might imply that idea of immunizing against failure. You also asked about the poor old recluse or hermit who might look like he'd be hauled out of his cave and asked to join in the comradely fellowship that I propose, Alan William Morris. Well, I I meant to say that participation and engagement is among the things that one wants to stress in this flourishing view rather than opportunity for flourishing, that it should be active and not passive. And so the recluse was very actively engaging in his own private little affair. So I don't want to say when all of us have to be social animals, but I think all of us have to be doers and agents in one form or another to be flourishing. And obviously those three aspects of objectively worthwhile pursuits, autonomy, and subjective reaction or happiness, they're not things that we can maximally satisfy all of them all the time. And so one thing about my position is it really is impossible to talk anything about measuring or calibrating any of the things that I suggest, which is a problem, but also a bit of a dodge that I'll exploit as often as I can. Finally, responsibility. What about that poor, lazy person who hates working and then falls short on the contentment criterion? A lazy person should contribute, although I want to stress, and I did say this at one point, that it should not be a productivist conception of contribution. It shouldn't just be contributing to the economy. But nonetheless, I think we would want to get people to do things, and we would try and encourage them through an environment that enables and promotes that. I mean, I'm not talking about, again, hauling people out and forcing them to do things, but to provide an environment that encourages them to do things. Trying to get people to be active participants and contributors means they score highly on two of the criteria, and if they remain discontented, I guess it's a problem. So I think your last point about that was the one that started to get me worried, and I don't think I've answered it adequately, but that's what I would take a stab at doing. Thanks.
Okay, thanks also for these points. And I guess, I'll be brief because I want to hear what other folks have to say. I guess with respect to the first one, the challenge you pose, there might be compelling state interest, and then would be arbitrary discrimination if everyone knows. There may be compelling state interest to favor, having just one ideal promoted. And that doesn't look like arbitrary discrimination. So in a way, I think, that's exactly right. And so the formulation of the principle may not, as I put it in the paper, may need some tweaking to allow for that kind of possibility. Of course, it applies to the liberal principle as well, right? Just so it could be. In fact, what you've got here is something like a neutral reason for non-neutral state action. But it's a compelling reason of that type. Then any neutrality theorist should be willing to go for that. So I guess my first reaction was thinking, well, maybe look at this principle that I was proposing is just a prima facie principle. It's not an absolute principle. So it would be overridden for the type of case you're thinking. But maybe that's not the right way to think about it. Maybe I need to adjust the, maybe there should be a clause in there in the statement of the principle. It says there's not some compelling neutral reason that would favor one over the other. So in a way, I'm kind of conceding that you're right, that the articulation of the principle in favor may need some adjustment. Now, on the autonomy, there's a lot of the stuff. I mean, sometimes I'm defending pluralistic perfectionism, which is really just a family of views. Sometimes I'm speaking for my own views as a member of that family. And the stuff I say about autonomy, the arguments for that are all upstage in this paper. So I do think, they're good arguments to think that autonomy is a necessary component of a good life. So I am a limited pluralist in that sense. And I also think, and this is more controversial, I also think that what really is important is something like valuable autonomous agency. So people autonomously pursuing the good. And I think there's not really value to the autonomous pursuit of the bad. So in a sense, that's the line of argument that's going to speak to your worry about why doesn't my response to the people with false conception of the good, why do I take more seriously the value of autonomy? It's kind of making that a good way of life. So anyway, there are no arguments like that in this paper, but that's what I think, and they're kind of off stage. Now, about the last point, the rhetorical point, and I do take that seriously. I guess I think that most people that defend neutrality principles aren't content to just present it as a foundational principle. I think they're led to say, here are the considerations that support it, right? And then you can always say, okay, so those are the things that you really care about. So why don't we just draw, talk of state neutrality? I think not a whole lot turns on this, but it seems to me that the good arguments in favor of liberal state neutrality have appealed to things like self-respect. And so I wanted to take over that terrain. Now, I would be worried, and actually, when I was reading the paper, I was starting to worry about this. I would be worried if the expressive considerations about self-respect pull us away from restricted neutrality. So they actually give us reasons, in some cases, to not be in favor of restricted state neutrality. Then the rationale and the principle come apart, and that would be a more worrisome problem. But thanks.
Okay, just a couple of things. First of all, if the marriage has no benefits, why support it? Well, I quite agree. The key thing was that the idea that marriage might have no ordinary third-party benefits. Now, clearly, if marriage had ordinary third-party bads, you know, if Claudia Card was right that having this institution of marriage encourages murder and mayhem because it provides all these incentives for people to stay together when they're really sick of each other. So then there would be a good reason to oppose marriage. But what about the case where, you know, the evidence on the cause and effect and on the is inconclusive? Does that mean we have to get rid of marriage? That just seemed counterintuitive to me. And on the partiality point, I agree with Scheffler about the importance of basic human good of
non-instrumentally valuable relationships.
Yes, but the question was whether it's consistent with a principle of liberal neutrality to assert that there is an important human good in raising one's own child, and whether that's a legitimate kind of value to appeal to in justifying a public policy. And at least if you have a strict view of neutrality, it might not be. And so again, that was it's not that I doubt that, it's that if I was, and so what I'm trying to do in the paper is argue for marriage, but to hang on to this public reason objection to conservative arguments against same-sex marriage. So I'm not sure if I can, that's what I wasn't sure if we can do. Okay, let me, one more point about the critics, could accept or can't reject. I think the point in the last part of the paper there can be restated in terms of reasonable rejection. The requirement, no reasonable rejection requirement, it's not a no actual rejection, it's no reasonable rejection. So what do we mean by no reasonable rejection? And I think there's going to be an ambiguity there between, do we mean that no reasonable person could reject it right now? Or do we mean that? Do we mean something more something else by reasonable rejection? I mean, if at all it is that if the requirement is that no person we classify as reasonable now rejects the view in question, that's going to be a very demanding standard. I think of myself as reasonable, but there's lots of views that I have that are probably wrong and that you could probably talk me out of. But if my being reasonable and my now rejecting a particular view is a sufficient veto over state action, that's going to be a very, very demanding standard. The alternative is say that the impossibility of reasonable, say, you know, someone can't reasonably reject something. The way to interpret that is to say, that's to say that in the long run ideal speech situation, everyone would converge, and that's why we say someone is not reasonable to reject. So I still think there's an ambiguity there. Although, fortunately, you didn't get to your last question about metaphysical and empirical, because I'm not sure you may be able to talk me out of some of that there. Okay.